I'm going to start out with a little mental provisioning from rock star Jimmy Buffett. And he's got a great line in one of his songs, which is that some things are still a mystery to me and other things are much too clear. And I sort of use that as a guide to figure out the kinds of things that I emphasize both in this book and my other writings. I'll give you a really good example. I suspect many of you have had or given performance evaluations. Sort of an amazing literature to look at, because if performance evaluations were a drug, it could not receive FDA approval. About 50% of the times it makes things better, and about 50% of the times it makes things worse. And there are a few companies that seem to do it well, but for the most part, a lot of companies and a lot of bosses struggle.
Speaking on Background Briefing today is Robert Sutton, a professor in organizational behavior from the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And his subject will interest almost all of us: how to be a good boss and how to spot a bad boss, and also something about good and awful employees. I'm Chris Bullock. Today, in his talk at the Commonwealth Club of California, Robert Sutton concentrates on the impact both good and bad bosses and employees can have on the corporation they work for, and the impact they can have even on the bottom line. He weaves together evidence and case studies to identify the mindset and actions of the most successful bosses. Professor Sutton sits on many editorial boards. He's been named as one of the top 10 business academics, and he writes for most of the world's major newspapers and business weeklies. And, as you'll hear, he's the man behind the well-known ARSE test, A-R-S-E, is the acronym for Asshole Rating Self-Exam. Robert Sutton.
Let me start out, before I start digging into some of the nuances of my argument, there is this expression, which I'm sure that many of you have heard. I actually found a speech somewhere where the famous CEO of General Electric, Jack Welch, said it, that it's not all about you, and you've probably heard that. Well, I think that actually for bosses, that's not completely true. I would describe that as a useful half-truth, not a fact. And the reason that it's not a fact is that it turns out, and we'll dig into this in a little bit more detail, that if you look at what the best bosses do, they're actually quite self-focused on how others respond to them and actually monitor their behavior and think about their behavior very closely. And it's not for egotistical or arrogant reasons. It's because they realize that the way that other people respond to them has a huge effect on their effectiveness, both in terms of the quality of the work that people do and also in terms of their well-being. They also realize, and this is a fact of life for every boss, sometimes bosses complain about it, but the lot in life for every boss, especially as you get more senior and more powerful, is you will get more blame and more credit than you deserve. And since people are watching you very closely, in terms of sort of managing, if you will, the impression that others have of you, that's also part of your job. So the problem is, though, and I call this the toxic tandem, is on one hand, there's a lot of evidence that a boss's self-awareness is one of the most important things that determines his or her effectiveness. But there's something about being in a position of power, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, that leads people to be especially clueless. And to give you an introduction to this topic, many of you probably will remember the especially dark days. Things aren't exactly wonderful now, but the especially dark days in 2009, late 2008, after the meltdown when firms were doing an enormous number of layoffs. So my response was to write a book on, or not a book, an article on how to be a good boss in a bad economy. So I gave some speeches to different audiences. And after doing one at Stanford in one of our executive programs, I had a guy walk up to me and, you know, sort of afterwards, he sidled up to me and he said, "Let me tell you my interesting shoes story." So here's the story. He said that one of the executive assistants in his firms, walked up to one of the executive vice presidents and said, "When are the layoffs coming?" And he looked completely surprised because, in fact, layoffs were coming, but it also had been a very well-kept secret. And so he admitted they were coming. So he said, "How did you know?" He said, "When you have bad news, rather than looking us in the eye, you look at your shoes. And you've been running around the office looking at your shoes all day, and we figure since the firm's in trouble, the layoffs are coming. And the reason that story, I think, is so illustrative of actually a large body of behavioral science research is when you put people in positions of power, they become less self-aware and more focused on themselves. But the people who they lead in particular will focus on them more closely. So you end up with sort of like a toxic tandem, I would call it, or a disconnect. And in particular, a great quote from Susan Fiske, a psychologist, the way she describes this, attention is directed up the hierarchy in an effort to predict and possibly influence what's going to happen to them. People gather information about those in power. It turns out that this happens not just to human beings, but if you look at research on apes, it happens in baboon troops too. There's some great anthropological research that shows the typical member of a baboon troop glances up at the alpha male every 20 or 30 seconds. So if you're in a position of power, even if you don't realize it, they're watching you. And along these lines, there was a really sort of cute and interesting story, but also telling story from Linda Hudson that was in the New York Times about a year ago. And she described how when she got her first promotion to a real senior executive position, it was actually a president of General Dynamics, that the day before she went to work, her first day on the job, she went to Nordstrom. And what happened was that one of the salesperson taught her how to tie her scarf in sort of a special kind of way. So she went to work the first day with her scarf tied that way. And then the day afterwards, she noticed there was 15 or 20 women who had their scarves tied exactly the same way. And although it doesn't always play out exactly like that, I think that her quote is great, that it wasn't just about how I dressed, it was about my behavior, the example, the tone I set, the way I carried myself, how confident I was, all those kinds of things. And so people in power tend to be watched very closely. But unfortunately, and this is where you really get a large amount of research about the countervailing forces, and sort of a shorthand summary of the review of the literature is, when you put people in power, three things happen reliably. And these are, by the way, independently of personality, although certainly some people are going to suffer from this more than others. One is people tend to focus on their own needs and concerns. Second, they tend to focus little attention on the needs of others. And third, they act like the rules don't apply to them. I think I'm going to give you an experiment in a few minutes, but it's also interesting that if you look at it, research about when bosses especially suffer from power poisoning, it tends to happen after they have been leading hugely successful companies. Okay, so here's my study that sort of summarizes. This is one of my favorite studies. So this is a study that was done, reported by Dr. Keltner and Deb Grunfeld at UC Berkeley. And essentially what you had was a situation, UC Berkeley undergraduates. And so you had two of them were brainstorming ideas about how to solve social problems, like how to make the Berkeley campus more green and things like that. And one of them was the boss who evaluated the quality of their ideas. But the real intervention, since psychologists almost always lie to their subjects about what they're actually doing, was they brought in five cookies. So the real question was, since we know the social norm against taking the last cookie, what happened to the fourth cookie? And what they found was that the people in power tended to take the fourth cookie. And these being good, rigorous researchers, they did a good job of coming up with a three-item measure of disinhibited eating. They tended to eat with their mouths open. This was, they took videotapes and coded them, and they tended to leave more crumbs. So if you take it, now let's go back. So this is really the cutest study. It's not the most rigorous, but it's the most cutest power. It's the cutest power study. If you look at this, number one, paying more attention to my own needs. Two, less attention to the needs of others. And three, acting like the rules don't apply to me. And this happens and gets magnified in all sorts of ways. So you see the sort of toxic tandem problem in some of the bases of it. By the way, I should talk about the gender effects in this study. And essentially, the sort of piggy eating effects were driven by especially the effect of putting women in power. But what happened was that when men and women were out of power, men were pigs the entire time and women were kind of neat, but they became about as bad or a little worse than the low power men when you gave them power. So a lot of this was women being put in power, they become just as piggy eater as men, at least in this study. All right. So So that's sort of the setup. And I, just to back up for a second, sort of the core idea here is that to be an effective boss, what you've got to do, or if you have a boss, what your boss has to do is to find a way to be in tune with what it feels like to work for him or her. But there's a bunch of things about being in the position that make that hard to do. So, and I'm going to sort of dig into some of the more nuances of this with four different hallmarks of in-tune bosses. And let me start out with assertiveness. Although, if you look at research on leadership, much of the noise, or most of the noise, tends to be about things like charisma, for example. There's some new research that's coming out. Two researchers did this at Columbia. Their names are Ames and Frank Flynn. And what they looked to see across a series of survey studies to see which bosses were rated most effective. And the thing they kept seeing over and over again was that those who were most effective scored moderately on terms like competitive, aggressive, passive, submissive. They were moderately assertive, and they have this great line in the article that a moderately assertive boss is sort of like a perfectly solid dish. You notice that you don't notice how perfect it is. And I think that's sort of cute. But the other thing, when you dig into it, is that it isn't just that these effective bosses are always sort of going along at a medium level. The reason that they're moderately assertive is they sort of know when to turn it up and to push people around, because there are certain times in management life when people need direction, when people are doing things wrong, when they're lacking skills. There are times when bosses need to interject, and there are times when they need to back off. And in particular, I think one of the best quotes I've ever seen about this comes from the hated Tommy Lasorda. The Giants are in first place, at least still for now. I hope they stay there. And the day he took over as manager of the Dodgers, he had this fantastic quote: "I believe managing is like holding a dove in your hand. If you hold it too tightly, you kill it. If you hold it too loosely, you lose it." And I think that sort of gets at this notion of being sort of perfectly assertive. And so I gave a version of this talk a bunch of different companies last week, or the week before, and one of them was at Disney Studios, actually. And a woman actually sitting in the front row asked me, how do I learn to be a perfectly assertive boss? What's the key? And I think the secret is actually practicing the craft. It's not like just from hearing a speech or reading a book you can learn how to do it. It's something that you have to learn on the job, and to especially understand how to read the emotions and the like of the people you lead. Now, one time that I like to talk about is the times when it's especially important to not be assertive, not to interject. For starters, I think it's very important for every manager to know research. There's a really cool body of research, they call it, on self-enhancement bias. And what happens in leadership situations, it turns out that the more closely a boss watches his or her subordinates, the more advice they give, the more questions they ask, just the more closely they watch them, the higher they will rate the outcome of the work, independently of the quality of the work. So if you're a boss, you've got to remember, if you're watching him and you're devoting all that effort, that you are literally doing a cognitive trick on yourself. So in general, the argument that I always make, and I stole this from my co-author Jeff Effer, is that first do no harm should be the motto of just about every boss. And this is especially important in creative work. And one of the best quotes I ever heard, I was on a panel with a guy named Bill Coyne, who headed R&D at 3M for a decade. And he said, after you plant a seed in the ground, you don't dig it up every week to see how it's doing. And I think that many bosses can't help but dig it up every 7 minutes with email now, since you can send them an email checking and checking and checking and checking. And by the way, the context in which I heard this, one of the favorite times, or the best times to hear a CEO or executive talk, is after they've retired. He had just stepped down, and he was telling the audience, this was at Motorola, how one of the most important things that he learned is heading R&D at Motorola was, if he got senior management involved in important projects too early, they would mess it up by asking too many questions and setting deadlines and asking when it was to be commercialized. So he used this expression, which was, I'd show them pretty shiny things. I'd show them projects that were really interesting, but he didn't think were going to go anywhere, just to distract them so the people doing the real work could be left alone. So that's a boss who's got your back, and we'll talk about that later.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. At the Commonwealth Club of California, Professor Robert Sutton went on to discuss other basic things that good bosses know about and practice, such as the mum effect and wisdom.
Another thing that's related to being in tune with folks, and something that I've been working on and thinking about ever since I did some work with IDEO, which is a famous innovation firm, and especially worked with a guy named David Kelly, who's the founder, is this notion of wisdom. And there's sort of a challenge if you're a boss in that you've got to come across as confident so that people will follow you and be confident in their own actions and confident in your abilities. But essentially, the best bosses sort of dance on the edge of overconfidence, but they have enough self-doubt and humility to stop them from getting engaged and turning arrogant and pigheaded. And the way that I tend to talk about this is to say that the best bosses have the attitude of wisdom. So that means they have the courage to act what they know, act on what they know in concert with the humility to doubt what they know. So there's a sort of balancing act, if you will, between courage and boldness and sort of humility and humbleness at the same time. And speaking of former CEOs, one of the best descriptions I ever heard of this, and this is a quote that's even longer than this, I ever heard came from Andy Grove when I went to a speech that he gave right after he stepped down as head of Intel. And he does a nearly perfect job of capturing what the attitude of wisdom is. He said, "I think it's very important for you to do two things. Act as your as if your temporary conviction is a real conviction, and when you realize you are wrong, change course very quickly." So you've got this, the sort of courage to act and the humility to doubt it. And he went on to say, "Investment decisions or personnel decisions and prioritization don't wait for the picture to be clarified. You have to make them when you have to make them, and you take your shots and clean up the bad ones later." And so again, you've got this sort of notion of having the courage to act in what you know while the humility to change course. And one of the most important things that good bosses do in these situations is they listen. And one of my favorite quotes along these lines comes from John Wooden, who makes this argument that faking it is worse than not doing it at all. And along these lines, when I was thinking about this this talk, I started remembering, I better be careful because I'm going to say the name of the firm and I'm going to get in non-disclosure trouble. But let me just say it's an American icon. And we were at an all-day meeting. And those of you who have been in business and the like know when you're in a really bad all-day meeting how absolutely horrible it can be. So this was like one of the worst meetings I've ever been at. And I was there actually with my Stanford colleague, Huggy Rao. And the reason that the meeting was so bad was there was one guy who was the most senior guy in the room who talked and talked and talked and talked. And about 2 or 3 hours into it, I remember one of my friends was in the room. Her name is Marla. She turned to me and she said, so he's just spewing out PowerPoint decks. And she would sort of point to which PowerPoint decks they were. And finally, about 2 in the afternoon, he sat next to me and was quiet for 3 or 4 minutes. And he looked at me and gave me this sort of, well, I can't say this in there, blank eating grin. And he said, "It looks like I'm listening. I'm not really listening. I'm just reloading, thinking about what I'm going to say next." And the interesting thing about that, he thought that he was faking it, but this was actually a reasonably well-run company. And the word got out to a bunch of his fellow executives and his superiors that he was all transmission and no reception. And he actually got in a lot of trouble and got what looked to me like a demotion. So it was actually a well-managed firm. But the notion here that listening is important is obviously key. Now, another thing that goes on here, that even if you're the most sort of like emotionally stable, warm, fuzzy boss, you've still got to realize that people have all sorts of incentive not to break bad news to you. And one of the causes, there's lots of causes, but one of the causes is there's something called the mum effect, which we've got a bunch of experiments that show that sort of unconsciously, automatically and powerfully, when somebody gives us bad news, it causes us to dislike them. And we don't even realize it's going on. And the thing that's interesting about the mum effect, it's one thing if you've just got one superior, but think about the filtering effect going up the hierarchy when there's some bad news and how each person sort of cleans it up a little bit. And one of the best stories I know about this was when Richard Feynman, the late Nobel Prize winner, he was a member of the Rogers Commission, which studied the purposes for why the Challenger exploded. And what he did in this sort of rogue, unofficial way was he went around and asked a bunch of questions. And one of the questions he asked something that has still never happened, which is, what's the likelihood that the main shuttle engine would fail? And the estimates of the engineers who were sort of on the ground dealing with the stuff, 1 in 200. The most senior NASA executives, 1 in 100,000. And I think this is especially telling, given if you look what happened with the BP oil deck, because the senior executives were saying it was virtually impossible, and the people working on the deck were saying, this is pretty scary. We're afraid something bad's going to happen because there's so much performance pressure on us. And you can just sort of see the filtering going up the chain. So that's the mum effect. The other thing that's important for developing an attitude of wisdom, if you will, and something, I teach Stanford students, they're very smart, they're very good, as the quote says, is fighting as if they're right, but listening as if they're wrong is something that's really tough when you've gotten straight A's your whole life and everybody told you you were the smartest person in the room. And so the argument is that the best bosses make it safe for people to fight in an atmosphere of mutual respect, especially when they're doing creative work. And a great quote here from William Wrigley of chewing gum fame, when two people in business always agree, one of them is unnecessary. And I think that's very important, especially if you're doing creative work. And I think the icon in the Bay Area, and one of my favorite bosses I've ever interviewed, is Brad Bird of Incredibles fame. So Brad Bird was the Academy Award-winning director of both The Incredibles and also of Ratatouille. But before he got to Pixar, he told us a story about how he was brought in to do a turnaround job at a film that was critically acclaimed, but was not a huge hit, called The Iron Giant, which some of you may have seen. And he described how he went in the first day, and Brad's a very sort of charismatic, exciting guy. And in fact, if you've seen The Incredibles, his voice is that woman who's the half Japanese, half German clothes designer who doesn't like the cape. So he's very sort of animated. And he tells Huggy Rao and me, I gave them the best speech the first day. I said things like, everyone will be humiliated and encouraged together. Well, it'll just be like a fabulous sort of like, we'll brawl it out, we'll fight every day, and we'll come up with the best answers. And then he said he started working, and they sat there for 3 weeks and just looked at him, just sort of stared at him. And what had happened, he described to us, is the director before had been abusive, nasty, and arrogant, and had created a climate of fear in the room. And he said it took about 3 weeks before one of them argued with me just a little bit. And then he said, we built from that, and by the end of the film, we had really great, rollicking conflict. And he really is amazing, because just a week ago Friday, I gave a talk on this stuff at Pixar. And when I was talking to the producer, this guy, John, he was describing how that conflict was always there, and he described working with Brad as sort of being in loving conflict with Brad Bird, which I think is sort of like a beautiful description of an effective boss. Some comments on fighting. There's probably at least two times when constructive conflict is not worthwhile to do. The first is when you're in the very early stages of brainstorming. You just want to get a bunch of ideas out there. At that point, arguing is not a good idea. You just want the free flow of ideas. And then the other time is after the decision is made, stop fighting because it undermines implementation. And this is at Intel, for example, the sort of famous company down the road. 100% of all employees get classes in constructive confrontation. It's very much consistent with the Andy Grove philosophy. And Andy Grove makes this argument, and he makes this to the MBAs, and it's really interesting. His argument is that if you disagree with a decision, you should especially work hard to implement it perfectly. And his reasoning is this, and that because that way when it fails, you know it's because of a bad idea, not a bad implementation. I like that sort of little jujitsu there to turn it around. But I think that it's very important, and when a decision has been made and you can't do anything about it, there's an argument that as a leader or a follower, you either should help implement it or get out of the way, because it's a pretty dangerous thing to do.
You're listening to Professor Robert Sutton speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California recently. He is a highly regarded business educator and author of many books. His most recent is called Good Boss, Bad Boss. And this is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. The role of superstars in corporations is now examined. Those who sell the most, turn organisations around, or add some kind of glow or glamour to a corporation. Are they worth it? Robert Sutton.
Okay, so the next point, and something I've been actually really obsessed with and writing more and more about, is this notion of eliminating the negative being more important than accentuating the positive, and what a strong evidence-based case there is for it. So let me start out and give some hints at this and talk about research about who are the best superstars. Now, one of the things that there's been a lot of research and a lot of controversy in academic research in is whether or not firms should have superstars, whether or not they should anoint a small percentage of people as being sort of the most important people. And there's controversy about this. There's some great books by a guy named Boris Groysberg, a Harvard professor, and he'll show you that superstars are overrated. And one thing on the gender side you might want to know, there's some really interesting evidence from Boris that stealing female superstars does help you. They do adapt to the new environment. Men don't do so well. They tend to do worse, and their firms left unaffected in a number of different fields. But in general, in all firms, there's going to be sort of a model of what a great employee is, what a star employee is. And the evidence you keep seeing over and over again is, regardless of the compensation system that a firm uses, when they're good at turning knowledge into action, when the bosses are effective, what they do is they anoint people as superstars who are not only individually great performers or even lead a great business, they're people who help everybody around them succeed, not just themselves. And probably the firm that's most vicious and unnice about this, but very effective in some ways, is General Electric, where they have a brutal policy of dismissing people who were great individual performers, but who were undermining what he believed was the GE culture. So they were really nasty about being a team player. And other places like IDEO that I work with, they're quite good about this. And McKinsey, I know McKinsey pretty well. McKinsey puts a huge emphasis on you helping your colleagues succeed. One of my favorite examples of this, and there's a little bit of data here, is my co-author, Jeff Pfeffer. He went to Suits University, and there's a story that George Zimmer told him at Suits University, which was about their top salesperson in one of their Seattle stores. And this was a guy who kept undermining the team sales environment. He kept stealing sales from other folks, wouldn't help them out, and so on. And in the men's warehouse culture, you're supposed to help your other folks succeed. So what they did was they fired this guy and they waited to see what would happen. And even though he was the top salesperson in the Northwest area, the sales in the store went up 30%, even though no person reached his level of star sales. And to me, that's sort of a good sign of this effectiveness criteria. So this guy was a rotten apple. And speaking of rotten apple, what this brings me to is one of the most amazing literatures that I've ever read. And this is the name of an academic article. In fact, you can find it online, get a free PDF. It's called Bad is Stronger Than Good. And essentially the argument is, whether you're looking at personal relationships, work relationships, essentially that a bad interaction packs 5 times the wallop of a good interaction. So that means, and if you're in a long-term relationship with your spouse or lover or whatever, you should probably know about this research. So that means that for every bad thing you do, you've got to do at least 5 good things to make up for it. And my wife's sitting in the front row, so I always think of this when I sort of deal with my wife. But it's actually a very important thing. And in the workplace, you get things like the emotional wallop of a bad incident is 5 times of the emotional wallop of a good incident. And this brings us to the research on rotten apples. There's a wonderful and scary body of research that shows that if you've just got one rotten apple in a group, so somebody who's a deadbeat, somebody who's a downer, somebody who's a jerk, that they bring down performance 30 or 40% in a medium-sized group. And the evidence is, if you bring in just another star, it's not going to offset the power of that one destructive character. You've got to, as a boss or as a group, deal with that person, either change their behavior or get rid of them. There's 2 reasons why this happens, according to the research. The first one is a simple distraction approach, which is, if you've got somebody who's a jerk or a deadbeat in your group, you're going to devote so much energy to them that it takes away from the amount of time you spend on the task. And the other thing has to do with the contagiousness of it all. It turns out there's evidence that bad behavior, especially bad emotions, are especially contagious. So it spreads to everybody else. And there's 2 kind of general approaches there, and what you do, I think, depends on the history with the person. One is the fix them strategy. One of my favorite examples of this, this comes from Mark Marquez, who's been the coach of the Stanford baseball team for more than 30 years, also led the Olympic gold medal team for the U.S. at one point. And so I once had Mark come up and do some discussion on executive for an executive ed group, and he told the executives, and I couldn't believe he said this, he said, when I have a prima donna who's a great player but is being a lousy team player, he said, I tell them a lie. And it's sort of shocking that he tells this lie consistently. And the lie is that that if you don't become, the lie is the scouts think you're a great individual performer, but they're concerned that you're a lousy team player. And the reason he said that it was better to tell them that lie than to hear it from somebody else was if the scouts actually started believing that, it would hurt them more. So that's the sort of fix them strategy. And he said it actually was often very effective, including with some major league stars he named. And then there's the approach that they use, and I'm going to be careful about this because of the radio. There's a firm called Baird, which is a financial services firm in the Midwest. They actually were very successful even through the downturn. And one day I was reading Fortune magazine, and I read that they attributed their success, both financial and the fact they were on the best place to work list, to the fact that they had a no-jerk rule, though they used the A word. So I interviewed Paul Purcell in quite a bit of detail on the phone for about an hour and a half one day, and he said that during interviews, I look at folks and I tell them if they're a jerk, I'm going to fire them. And I went on and asked him, what do you mean by a jerk? Because if you look at my book on jerks, I argue that jerks are people who leave people feeling demeaned and de-energized. But he made an argument that's sort of closer to the Men's Warehouse or General Electric argument, which for him, somebody is a jerk is somebody who consistently puts his or her needs ahead of the company, ahead of their peers, and ahead of customers. And that's somebody he meant as a jerk. And I think that goes back to the definition of a superstar and the kind of rotten apples I'm talking about. Okay, one more. So the last thing that I'm going to talk about is the importance of serving as a human shield. If you want to have a good, strong, single-item survey measure of whether or not a boss is a good boss, if you ask the question, do you believe your boss has your back? It's actually a very strong predictor of a whole bunch of other effectiveness measures. So by serving as a human shield, I mean things like protecting people from harm, intrusions, distractions, indignities, and so on. To give you an example, there's a great quote from management guru Henry Mintzberg I just love. Someone once defined a manager half in jest as someone who sees the visitors so that everyone else can get the work done. And that's part of your job as a boss, is to do all that ceremonial stuff so that the rest of the people can actually get their work done. And I think that's what a good boss does rather than passing that stuff on. Another thing that a good boss does in terms of protecting people, and I think one place where you can really see a boss's stripe, is their meeting behavior. So if you kind of want to get an idea of how you would take control and really push people around in a meeting, you would do things like arrive late consistently. You know, just like 5 or 6 minutes, everybody has to wait for you. It's sort of a sign that you're so important the meeting can't start without you. And then what you do is you hold them pretty consistently 5, 10, 15, 25 minutes late, because after all, you're so important that whatever they have to do in their job and their personal life is not as important as you are. But if you actually wanted to see what led to people being able to do their work and be effective, you would start and end meetings on time. There's a couple of great examples from a guy named Will Wright. And my favorite example he describes is about a creative guy named Ocean Quigley, who he viewed as the canary in the coal mine. And Ocean Quigley was a very impatient sort of guy. And when the meeting got bad, he'd raise his hand and ask if he could be excused. And at that point, Will Wright knew that it was time to end the meeting. The other thing that Will Wright is kind of famous for is that he used to charge people $1 whenever they called a meeting, just to stop and make them think about it. And he said, I got a lot of dollars and went to a lot of meetings, but at least people thought about it. And then the last thing that a good boss does, and this is especially in more complex bureaucracies, is they protect people from idiocy from on high. And the fact remains, and this even can happen in fairly small organizations, that sometimes the boss or the senior team does stuff that actually is not very smart, and a good boss lower down protects. So I'll give you a good example. So this is about 1986. I did my dissertation on organizational death, and so I read in the news newspaper that there was a large bank that was closing 125 branches in California. I won't say the bank, but there's only so many banks that have 125 branches. And so I wrote them immediately and asked if I could study their closing process. So I went up to San Francisco in a large skyscraper. I met these folks who called themselves the Retail Action Team, who were in charge of closing all these banks. And so we made a little deal, which was to see if we could work together. I would do case studies of four effective and ineffective closings, branch closings, and they defined effectiveness largely in terms of the amount of business retained. So I go to the first four, and I kept hearing at the first four, the effective ones, the same story over and over again, which was the reason we were successful was we ignored all the advice from the Retail Action Team. And I remember a branch manager in San Jose holding this giant book they had put together, and he said, the secret to my success was I ignored every single thing in this book. And then the other ones, as you can guess, the bad closings, they kept using the word frustration to describe trying to implement these stupid procedures. And also, by the way, I learned a lesson which I still haven't quite recovered from, which was I went up to the skyscraper to give the report to the Retail Action Team, and I sort of gave them the headline in the first two or three sentences. And everybody left. Like, literally, they all of a sudden they had another meeting to go to, and they left me with the most junior guy who walked me to the elevator. It was like I was out of the building in like 6 minutes. Sort of like a lesson about flexibility. Okay, so let me make a parting thought, and then we have about 10 minutes for Q&A, Mary?
We have a few more minutes than that, but that's...
Okay. So there's lots of things that determine whether or not a boss is a good boss or a bad boss and is in tune with his or her people. But using the evidence, if I was going to pick maybe just one thing that might be most powerful... So I've got a colleague at the University of Virginia. His name is Rob Cross. And sort of by accident, he was doing a survey of a whole bunch of things that determine the effectiveness of bosses and other folks in large organizations. And he threw in this one question. And the question was, after you talk to this person, do you have more or less energy? That's the whole question. It's a yes-no question. When we did the analysis, it turned out that this was the most powerful predictor of things like, well, performance evaluations I've already mentioned, promotions, and also the effectiveness, energy, and innovation of the people surrounding, in particular the leader. And so I think that that's really a good question if you're a boss you might want to ask about yourself or maybe think about your own boss is how do you feel after you talk to the person or how does it feel after they talk to you? And the reason I think that's an important one to end with and another thing to emphasize is this isn't about charisma or flash. In fact, Rob Cross emphasizes that some of the best energizers are actually quite boring in person. That they're kind of dull, but the reason they energize you is they make you feel confident in what you're doing. And kind of a good example, but A.G. Lafley, who led Procter & Gamble for about 10 years, fantastically successful and well-loved, having met A.G. about three times, his affect reminds me of Mr. Rogers. He speaks in these really simple sentences. In fact, his motto was keep it Sesame Street simple. That was one of his mottos when he led Procter & Gamble. At the same time, we're having the meltdown where, frankly, none of those CEOs really knew what was going on in their companies. That was part of the problem because it was so complicated. So that's an example of somebody who is not charismatic or exciting in the traditional sense, but people who work for him just love working with him because they felt energized and like they could be trusted. So my two diagnostic questions from good boss, bad boss, you might want to think about if you're a boss. Do you know what it feels like to work for you? And two, if they had the choice, would your people work for you again?
Time for questions, which were moderated by Mary Cranston, past chair of the Board of Governors at the Commonwealth Club and a leading attorney. The first question was what could Robert Sutton say to an employee who was working under a toxic boss but who, for various reasons, could not leave their job? Does Robert Sutton have any advice?
You know, my first answer is life is life. You've got to do a political calculation. And the first thing is, well, so can you actually talk to the boss? We have a conversation with the boss about how he or she is screwing up. If your boss is a severe narcissist, it probably won't work. He or she will just get mad at you. So you got to do that analysis. The second thing is, well, can you organize the political power to undermine the boss? In fact, there's a nice body of research that shows that the way that bully bosses tend to be upset is not when one person goes and complains, because then they're just viewed as a nut or can be viewed as crazy. It's when people go together. So if you have a bad boss, document and do it together and confront the boss or the boss's boss. And that's how it actually gets done. But there are other sorts of, I would describe it as lesser forms of control, which is the avoidance approach. One is, if you got a really bad boss, it's sort of like a toxic substance. Do everything you can to avoid contact with them. And then the last thing is, and this is something in my old age I'm trying to get better at. I'm not very good at it, but there's a lot of evidence that it works, and it's sort of Buddhist, is to learn the fine art of emotional detachment, of not caring. And there's management writers always write about the importance of passion. But if you're in a bad situation, you can't change it. You have no influence. Learning to be emotionally detached and to not let it touch your soul, I think, is an important thing.
So we've also got some questions here about how a good boss would deal with a bad employee. And you've had some examples throughout your characteristics of a good boss. But if you could kind of summarize what you think the techniques of a good boss to work with underperforming employees in general. What's the array of things?
Well, I think the basic thing is either you try to fix them or you get rid of them. But to that point, that's really basic. But one of the things that tends to happen, and it's, I think, easy for all of us to get involved in or to fall prey to, is the evidence essentially is that the most effective bosses in all sorts of industries, in all sorts of situations, they do the dirty work. They don't let it fester. And they take the time and go through the effort to start having the warnings and have the conversation with them and try to figure out how they can save the situations. And also, on the firing part, as nice a guy as I am, I would make the argument there's a lot of times in a lot of companies where people wait too long to get rid of the incompetent or otherwise sort of like toxic characters. So there's the point we've got to get rid of them. And sometimes, I get lots of emails about this. There's some people who write me and say the best thing that ever happened to me is somebody fired me and sent me off on a career that I actually was good at instead of something I wasn't very good at. And so there is an argument that the best bosses actually have to deal with it. So that's the worst thing is it's so easy to ignore that stuff and let it fester, but I think effective bosses actually are more action-oriented.
So one of the things that you mentioned in this book, and you've talked about it in some of your other books, is this whole concept of smart talk and how it is destructive in business, particularly from bosses. Could you kind of talk to the audience a little bit about what that's all about and how to alleviate that?
Oh, sure. So one of the things, and this started with a book I wrote with Jeff Pfeffer 10 years ago now, life's going fast, called The Knowing Doing Gap. And one of the things that we discovered was that in a lot of the organizations we studied, we kept running into people who seemed to be paid and rewarded for saying smart things rather than actually doing them. And there's lots of things that I think good organizations do to overcome the smart talk trap. Just for starters, one of the things that I think is really important and sometimes ignored is to have people run a business who actually understand the business. And then another thing, which I already talked about, is one of the classic smart talkers' tricks is to use really complicated, convoluted language. In fact, there's studies where they'll have people estimate people's IQs, and the more incomprehensible they are, the higher IQ we tend to assign them. So if you want to make people think you're smart, use words they don't understand, use jargon. But if you actually want them to get stuff done, you sort of follow the Sesame Street simple model from Procter & Gamble. So those are some of the things that I think about. But it really is interesting because there are lots of organizations where people seem to make decisions and think they're done, and that implementing stuff is for the little people and beneath them, and that's trouble in the long term.
One of the interesting parts of your book is self-test as to whether you are a certified asshole.
Yes.
Could you just talk a little bit about what that self-assessment's all about?
Well, so this is a thing called the ARS test, which is online, and you can take it if you want. And I think about 250,000 people have taken the ARS, some ridiculous number like that. And essentially, I'm trying to remember some of the things, but if you feel like you are surrounded with incompetent idiots and you can't help letting them know the truth every now and then, that might be a bad sign. What's another one? You secretly enjoy watching people suffer and squirm. Oh, here's one that actually, you sometimes can't contain your contempt toward the losers and jerks in your workplace. So you might want to think about how you're doing on that test.
One of the really interesting findings in your book was the look you took at the total cost of difficult boss behavior in a company or in the economy. Could you talk a little bit about your findings?
Well, and there's actually a lot more research just since my book came out, but there's a lot of evidence that if you look at, even if somebody is, say, like a star salesperson, if you look at the actual costs, so I actually have the example of a salesperson from a large organization I call Ethan in the book, and the folks in HR got upset at him and calculated the total cost of this one jerk for 1 year. And these numbers, by the way, are slightly fudged because I had to protect the innocent and the guilty. But the estimate was about $160,000 a year. And one of the costs, which really does crack me up, is this guy burned through about a secretary a year. So it cost a lot of money to replace his secretary for two reasons. One was nobody in the firm would work for him, so you'd have to go outside. And then the other thing is, and I've heard this repeatedly from people in HR, I didn't realize this was a phenomenon in corporate America, but difficult bosses, and I've probably heard this 15 times now, their assistants will get battle pay, so an extra $5,000 or $10,000 a year to work for that jerk. And it's amazing, when I talk about this at HR conferences, I will typically have like a bunch of HR people come up and tell me the story about the jerk bosses in their organization who get battle pay. But yeah, they can be quite expensive. And besides that, they make life miserable.
One of the questions I got had to do with if you were the top boss in an organization and you were very interested in making sure that you were able to spot and take care of jerks in the system, what would you recommend that top boss do?
Well, I think that what the top boss should do is, first of all, you got to identify them, and you should never believe their superiors, and it's not to diss their superiors, but some of the most effective ones, actually what my wife calls strategic a-holes, are really good at kissing up and kicking down, and you may never actually see them. So you've got to find some way to make it psychologically safe for their subordinates to tell you the truth. So I think that's sort of like lesson one. And then I think it's like any other performance problem, that you give them warnings and you give them coaching, and if it doesn't work, well, you show them the door.
What would be the best practices in your mind for an organization to make sure that it's safe for subordinates to report up?
Oh, so first of all, you can tell right away, because this kind of reminds me, various times I've had my students do case studies about psychological safety, and what they tend to ask this really good question, which are, who are the complainers and the whistleblowers? Can we go talk to them? And if they can't be identified in your organization, if all those people are gone, left, stigmatized, pushed in the corner, whatever, that's a sign that they don't exist. So I would do that diagnostic question. And to me, the real issue is when a complaint or something nasty comes up, what sort of happens to it? So you got to deal with it quickly and you got to deal with it effectively. But, you know, in a world of political power, sometimes people want to squish people who are saying bad things about them. So going back to doing the political analysis in your organization, if you're going to complain or point the finger at people, make sure you have an exit option or you have a lot of friends to take care of you and cover your back.
We want to know about yourself. How good are you as a boss? Are you always a good boss?
No, I actually do not think I'm a great boss, which is, I don't. I think I'm better at studying it than actually doing it. And my wife's a much better boss than I am. And for example, I actually just got the email today that we're going to have a new department chair in our department at Stanford. After 10 years, our department chair has finally stepped down. And I made it very clear to my dean that I was the last choice to run our department, given my skill and competence and interest. So I think I'm better at studying it than actually doing it. And to that point, I have learned from watching my wife, Marina, and talking to a lot of bosses that it's very easy to be critical of people who are in management positions, but man, are those jobs hard to do. So I think it's important to give people some respect and due who actually devote their lives to leading people and doing it effectively.
Robert Sutton, Professor of Management, Science and Engineering at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's the author of many books, a prolific writer for business journals, and a well-known speaker to corporations around the world. He was talking there at the Commonwealth Club of California, and there will be a link to some of his work as well as his website, where you can find the notorious ASS test, the word being an acronym for Asshole Rating Self-Exam, and a link to the Commonwealth Club of California, all on the Background Briefing website. I'm Chris Bullock. This is ABC Radio National.
On the Philosopher's Zone, that distinctive form of Japanese storytelling, anime. It can be dark, incredibly violent, and sexually explicit. But does it represent a distinctly Japanese worldview? And is it philosophical?
There's nothing to fear.
Find out on The Philosopher's Zone. Have a listen at the Radio National website.